Well, hello again. It's the next day now, and we finally finished the dressing of the frets after leveling, and there's a couple of more, there just are a few more points that can be made about it. First of all, take a look at it, see what you think of it, see if you can see this first of all. Hopefully I can show it to you. You can see that we now have nice shiny frets where we had before old looking corroded or oxidized frets. Now we have polished shiny frets, which is a vast improvement over what we had. No question about that. But the most important thing is that after the leveling process, we had a very flat or straight line or flat fretboard between the first and the 12th fret, or at least the 11th fret on the low E string side. And the first time that we had any gap between that straight line and the fret was on the 12th fret on the low E side, and we had no gap on the 12th fret on the high E side. And that's a good thing, because the low E string has a bigger vibration than a bigger amplitude of vibration than the high E side. So let me just say something here. Let's start again here. Let's see. Well, we're finally finished our fret dressing now. And I want to show you the final job. You can see how the light shines off the frets. But, of course, it's not so important that they're polished as that they're flat, but the polishing is probably almost as important, because it enables us to play. I'm trying to show you, see how the light glints off those frets now. It's a big difference. They're all shining, polished. I used polishing compound, turtle wax polishing compound, but first of all I had to, well, let's go through the steps briefly. We first of all adjusted the truss rod so that the fret board was as flat as we could get it. And after we did that, I was able to dress or sand the frets with a very long, perfectly straight piece of wood to which I glued some 180 grit sandpaper. Then, after that was done, I found that there was one spot that I'd missed, or two frets that I missed. I think it was the third and fourth fret that had a little bit of wear on the high E string location, which is the bottom here of the fretboard, just on those two frets. And just near that edge of that fretboard where the strings impact the fret. So I was able to work my sanding stick again on that side only, and until that was gone, and I put more pressure on those strings as I was doing it. But I ended up with still a very, very flat straight line, but no more imperfection or dents or wear on the fret. So, but the straightness is between the first fret and the 12th fret, and it was achieved on the high E string side, but on the low E string side it was between the first and 11th fret. And that clearance was zero on all of those frets, except, or virtually, you couldn't see any light between the straight edge, which I was using a 12-inch straight edge, and the frets, for any of those frets, except the first clearance on the low E string side was there was a slight clearance, or quite a substantial clearance for the 12th fret. And that's just the way it was before, and that's reasonable, seeing as the low E string vibrates at a higher amplitude than the high E string. And the 12th fret is the middle of the string, so it makes sense that we would do that. We would need a little bit of relief, as it's called, or clearance in the middle of the string. But why there was no relief on the other strings was because we deliberately set the fretboard flat using the truss rod before we started. Because you can't send anything flat if it's... I mean, you'd be doing an awful lot of sanding if you didn't set it as flat as you could get it, first of all. Using the truss rod adjustment to bend the neck, or what I had to do was tighten the truss rod, because that pulls the head lower relative to the body, which moves it down and away from the strings, therefore allowing us to make the fretboard essentially flat. Whereas it was curved. It's curved and it's low in the middle normally. So now what I've done, and the other way that the other adjustment we made after I was finished was to set up the capo on the strings. You put the capo on the first fret, and then you adjust. You put the capo on the first fret, right like that. I'm not going to do it because it's pointless. But you could just hold down the first fret and the 14th. The other thing is, you put the capo on, then you only need one hand to hold the 14th, and you can measure at the 6th fret to see what your clearance is. That's called relief. Now, once we had finished the dressing of the frets, the strings were still not on the guitar. Once we put the strings on the guitar, we automatically put tension on the neck, and that straight, that bends it, just tends to pull the head upward, raising the nut here, end of the string, relative to this part, causing a little bit of a gap between the string and the fretboard in the middle. Or in the middle of the string would be here, but of course, the thing is that the truss rod doesn't act on this part, it only acts on that part, so that the relief is in here. So we're interested in that relief being about 10 one-thousandths of an inch, or about 1/100th of an inch, 0.01 inches, and that's at the 6th fret. So I found in order to adjust the truss rod after I put the strings on, I needed to, since I'd tightened it before, I needed to loosen it, obviously, to get back to where I was before. And having the strings on it, I would get a little bit of relief, but then I needed to loosen that truss rod to let the neck go back to its normal or natural position slightly more so, and that gave me about 0.01, and more than that on the high E string side, but on the low E heavy gauge side, I found there was slightly less than 0.01 inches of relief on the 6th fret on that side, with the truss rod having been loosened about, well, I've got it written down. Now, you should always keep notes when you work on anything or do anything that's of any importance that you would like to remember, which is what I do. I've got a notebook. So this is my notebook. It's my 30th notebook. I've got 30 notebooks. I've just started using hardcover full-size notebooks. You can see I've made a table after I did all my fret dressing. I made a table. I wrote down every single height of every fret in a table form. The high or treble side, the middle of the fret, and the bass side of the fret. I wrote down a number for each of those. That's why there are three columns, and the fret numbers are on the one side there. Goes from 1 to 20 frets. So I have numbered them all, and in the book, I didn't number them on the guitar, but in the book. So I can read them, and I see that there's quite a bit of similarity between these numbers and the numbers I wrote down before in exactly the same format on an earlier table, which is right there. And those numbers, generally, you would have thought I removed material so the fret should be a little thinner. But in fact, because of the error in measuring it, and I was hoping to not make them much thinner, so I tended to lean towards the higher numbers on my second measurement. So it actually looks like my frets got higher. But I think, in all fairness, some of them got lower, and the first time I measured it, I think I leaned on the low side. So they didn't change much. I haven't looked out any averages. I should do that to find out what the average fret thickness is now, or fret height off the fretboard, compared to what it was before, because that would give me an idea how much metal I lost. But I know I didn't lose much, and it was only it was almost entirely in two places, which is around about the 12th fret area, around about the first three or four frets. That's where most of the material was removed. And the reason why was because when I had flattened the fretboard using the truss rod, the low E side became actually upward curved, so there was a bump in the middle here at about the 6th fret on this side, on the low bass side of the guitar. And I just noticed I forgot to turn off my furnace, so we'll get a rumbling sound on the recording. But the other side over here, I had, it was virtually flat. So if I had tightened the truss rod anymore, I would have gone beyond flat. If I'd gone beyond flat, I would have been sanding off more material than I needed. But while the fretboard was flat on the high E side, the frets themselves appeared to be higher near the nut at this end. So this end is the nut end, and this end is the saddle end, or the bridge end, or the body end, or whatever you want to call it. But I mean, it's the nut end at the head here. Head, nut, frets, body, bridge, saddle. The saddle is what the strings sit on. And these are the pins. I'm trying to think of the proper name for these. The string pins or something like that. They're the pins that hold the strings into the bridge and hold it on the saddle. Anyway, they hold the strings in place at this end, and then the strings are tightened at this end on the gears. So without explaining everything about the guitar at this point, what we're trying to just summarize is the fret dressing procedure that we went through. So we found out a couple of points now that we want to review here, and I wrote them down because I think these are the important points. We did, well, first of all, after I finished leveling the frets, and after I couldn't put the strings back on at that point, I had to then polish the frets first because I didn't want to make any wear on the strings until they were finally polished, so I wouldn't have to do all of that again. And I wanted them to be playable, and they're more playable when the strings are shiny, so you can push the string down and on the fret, and then you can bend it up by sliding it along the fret, and the fret has to be smooth for that. So the Gibson Blue Ridge, that's the guitar, and I love it. I love this guitar. It's a fantastic guitar. It's made in about 1969, we think, but we are unable to find the serial number on any master list of construction records for the Gibson guitar, for the Blue Ridge guitar. So it could have been possibly made significantly earlier, although it was not thought that any were made much earlier than about 1968, I believe, for the Gibson Blue Ridge. But it's difficult to be certain if we don't find the serial number, because they were made not in sequence. Oftentimes the serial numbers were out of sequence. It was a fairly haphazard sequence of numbers. So now we have, it's possible it was made about 1969 or maybe earlier, we don't believe it was made any later because of the changes in construction that took place. But anyway, I used to polish the frets. This is the most important thing about what I learned was, even though I should have learned a lot about the fret dressing, it actually was quite easy because I believed that these first three frets were too high and I didn't want to start sanding until I was certain that that area would be higher than this area when I was sanding. So I didn't really tighten the truss rod any more than I wanted to so that these would be exposed to more sanding pressure by having a low spot here. But the fret neck, or the fret board, seemed to be very straight when I sighted down it with my eye, because your eye can follow the line of the frets not as easily as it can follow the line of the fretboard itself. Because the fretboard itself is one continuous piece of wood, whereas the frets are, you know, interrupting that, intermittent along it. So it's, you can sight down either one, but to me the fretboard looks straight on the treble side. When I loosened the truss rod, I guess I loosened it an undeterminable amount. I wasn't really, or tightened it, I should say. I tightened it to pull the truss rod straight, flat. To pull the truss rod straight and then bend the neck flat, I should say. Bend the neck, the head down to make the neck flatter. Normally, the neck is bowed like that. The reason being, you need a little bit of relief here in which the strings can vibrate when you're playing. When you're fretting down here, the string will vibrate and you don't want it to touch these frets. And so the guitar is remarkably complex. It's a remarkably complex instrument and remarkably simple at the same time, unlike a piano, which has 88 or more, in some cases, notes with hammers and levers and, you know, many, many more components than a guitar, which has six strings, a soundboard, you know, a body, a neck, some tuning gears, etc. You know, a head, obviously. The head and neck are one piece, and you've got your bridge and saddle arrangement, and inside you have bracing and things. The bracing is, I learned just recently, just in the process of doing this fret dressing, I researched a lot about guitar construction to make sure I wasn't missing something. And we just had some Indian corn stew, that's why I'm kind of still digesting that. It's delicious Indian corn stew, all the hot pepper and Worcestershire sauce and all that, but it leaves a little bit of a job for the stomach to do, I suppose. Anyway, inside the guitar here there is a bracing, and the bracing is designed to do two things, at least, and they are mainly strengthen the soundboard for the purpose of withstanding the tension of the strings, which amounts to about the weight of a human being, about 70 kilograms, continuous. The guitar is strung continuously. You know, we don't take the strings off when we're done playing. You know, we leave it on continuously, and we put new strings on it when they wear out, etc. But these strings, being pulling with that amount of force, would eventually, over time, it may take a greater or lesser amount of time, but it would eventually tear the wood to pieces. It would collapse this soundboard, pulling it upward as it does. So the bracing inside, it's often the common bracing for acoustic steel string guitars is a cross bracing with a cross, one piece coming that way and diagonally the other way. So you have that. And then there are other ribs that come off that, but the strengthening is only part of what it's meant to do. The other function is it prevents certain modes of vibration of the soundboard. It can vibrate up and down. That's the sort of monopole vibration, or the fundamental vibration of a string, up and down. But then you've got harmonics with string vibration, and it's the same thing with the soundboard. The harmonics is where you have a bump and a trough on the other side, so you have a sine wave type of oscillation, which is the second mode after the fundamental, which is like a skipping rope, simple monopole, one movement in the middle. Now the middle of the string is right here, actually, because the bridge is here and the saddle is here, and where the strings sit, and they sit on the nut. So the middle is about here, the 12th fret. Now the monopole therefore occurs here on the string. In the soundboard, the monopole vibration would be about here in the middle of the soundboard. But there are also sine wave, secondary harmonics, and third harmonics, etc., of vibration here, and they go they go different directions here too. They can go cross, lateral, or front and back. Some of the purpose, therefore, of the bracing is to damp or eliminate some of those vibrations to produce a desired tonal quality of the, and you can find out what it is by tapping, for example, of the sound box or the soundboard, and it vibrates in sympathy with the back. So that this guitar, or many of these guitars, certainly not all of them, but many of them are designed. I was learning also from this 1 hour video on YouTube about guitar construction. The acoustic guitars are, many of them that is, designed to vibrate in sympathy at the front and back. So when I hit the front, and then I hit the front with it up against my body, different sound. Now, this one may not be designed that way, but some guitars are designed to be held against the chest while wearing them with a strap around your neck and standing up so that you can play them, you know, on stage in a standing position. But if I pull away from my body, see, this guitar I don't believe is made with that design intent, with the back vibrating together with the top. They're at a totally different resonant frequency, as you can hear. So that's interesting. I hadn't even done that test yet with this guitar, but this is a standard sort of guitar that people use standing up on stage. I think that's well known to many country western singers and many artists, or North American performers, and this is a North American guitar, Gibson, do perform standing up. So that is sort of understandable. And I think the person I... The video I was watching was an Australian maker of guitars. His name, it's not with me at the moment, but it was quite an interesting 1 hour video. He made smaller guitars for his children, for example, and he noted that in doing that he had to place the bridge further back on the body, which is not the desirable place, because you want it to be as close to the middle of the body as possible. That was his argument. Now, in this case, this guitar doesn't really put the bridge in the middle, or although it might be in the middle of the volume of the space inside. But because his young daughters had short arms, and they would need a short neck, therefore in order to create long enough strings, he moved the bridge back when he built their guitars. There are many things about guitar construction that are too many to go into right now, but it was very eye-opening for me to learn about, for example, that the bracing inside is shaped, and it traditionally was shaped by, after building the guitar, by playing the guitar, it was decided that the soundboard didn't have enough resonance or movement, and therefore the strings would be taken off again briefly, opened up so that you could get your hand inside, and then a small, tiny little plane was used to shave off wood from the, not from the soundboard, but from the braces, the cross bracing or the accessory or auxiliary bracing, whatever was there. And because that was done, it was decided that there's the furnace again. It was decided that this cross bracing should be built exactly the same when copies were made of North American instruments. For example, the Gibson guitar, I know this, the Blue Ridge, at least, is just the example I'm thinking of. The Blue Ridge, which is made by Gibson, is actually a copy of a Martin guitar. I'm not even sure if it's a particular Martin or which Martin. And the radius of the fretboard is 16 inches, which is the same as Martin, and that's one way of seeing the similarity or the fact that it's a copy. But there are other it's a complete copy. I mean, it's a copy of although I haven't looked at that many aspects at all. I've been reading that people say this is a copy of a Martin design. So that's where I don't have the source for that. Seems to be common knowledge. But Martin were such excellent guitars that, and Gibson did such a fine job of copying them that the Gibson Blue Ridge is considered to be an absolutely phenomenal guitar as far as sound quality and quality to price ratio is extremely good. I mean, they're very inexpensive. This is about a $1,500 guitar or $1,000 or whatever in that price range, and it is comparable to a guitar that costs maybe 10 times more or something like that. I mean, it's hard to improve on the sound of this guitar. You can add pearl inlays or all kinds of decorative things that you can get a $100,000 guitar, and there are $100,000 Martins. But to improve on the sound of this guitar, this is a very good value. Let's, I think, leave it at that. I'm not sure that it's incomparable or that there's nothing better, but I mean, because I haven't heard every guitar at all, but I think it's, I know it's phenomenal sound compared to some of the other guitars I've owned, but I mean, that doesn't put it on a relative scale. But people do say that the sound of these guitars is truly, truly good, excellent. And now, just one thing I wanted to show you. Perhaps this will be the last thing I show you. Although I want to go through the polishing of the frets, actually. I think I want to tell you that a little bit. But this is the board I was trying to explain how I had a large board. That's the part I wasn't able to get explain. I lost my board. I think it was right in front of me, or I forgot to bring it with me. There. I had this board. It was all one piece. There, like that. So then I used a long piece of cardboard with a hole in one end, put the nail through that hole, a piece of wood with a nail through one end of it and through this hole, and I used it as a compass to trace out my 16-inch radius curve and cut that, and then I made another curve that was 12 and an eighth. At the time, I didn't realize that this putting another hole in the piece of wood was going to be a different radius, of course. But it's handy to have that other radius because I don't know... 12-inch radius is very common, or at least reasonably common. I mean, it does exist in guitars, let's put it that way. Would be more accurate, but it's probably... I'm not certain how common it is now. Now, I can't check this anymore, but I'm quite certain it's unchanged from what I had before. With the strings on, I can't check that. See, I can't... You notice that? I can't... can no longer put this on and check the radius because it's sitting on the strings, and the strings are all different thicknesses, and I can't push them down in such a way that I can check whether this template cannot be used as a measuring device for the fret neck, the fret board or the frets, not with the strings on, but it can without the strings, and I made it for that purpose. But I don't need to measure them now because I got them beautifully set in height where they were totally level. Then I put the strings on. Well, first of all, I'll go through that process and then I'll tell you how I dressed the frets, and I finished dressing the frets first. Then I put the strings on, and I'll come back to how I dressed the frets at the end. So I put the strings on. Then I tightened the truss rod 1/6 of a turn. That gave me almost 1/10 of an inch relief at the 6th fret when holding down the 14th and the 1st fret. And I could just stick a 0.01, a 10/1000th of an inch piece of cardboard, just stick it there underneath the low E at the 6th fret, except that it was raising it up just a little bit, so I knew that I had a little less clearance than that. But I had more clearance than that on the high E side, so I was, happy with, a 10th is the desired amount, but because the low E side vibrates at a bigger amplitude than the high E side, it's better to have more clearance on this side. And I don't know why this guitar happens to be, maybe the neck is twisted or there's something a little bit different or wrong about this guitar, but we're going to try to turn it to our advantage, is always the thing, without doing any radical changes. So what we don't know how yet, but I have no idea what advantage it can be at this point. And yet, having noted that it was a little less than a tenth of an inch on this side, I decided to turn the truss rod a little bit more and see if I could, by loosening that a little bit more, and I did loosen it almost another twelfth of a turn, not an inch, a turn. So a sixth and a twelfth is about a sixth is 2/12, and 1/12 more is 3/12, is about a quarter of a turn, because there are six faces on a hexagonal nut. You can see a sixth of a turn changes from having one face pointing towards you to the next face pointing towards you. And another 1/12 of a turn changes from the face pointing towards you to the edge of the next, or the adjacent edge facing you. So you've got 3/12, or about almost a quarter of a turn is what I turned it, and that was from one face to the next face and then to the corner. So that was measurable. I could see what it was, and I could write it down, and I wrote it down in my book. So that's the way to do it. You write these things in your book. You keep track of everything so that you have a record. Not that it's ever going to go to court, although it might, but we keep records for that and other purposes that could come up, such as wanting to know. That's a good purpose. So here we have straight edge showed. It's a record of history, which is when you take, for example, time and place. You write down the time, the date and the time, and what you did. Now I should also have written the place. That's a good point. I should do that. I'll do that from now on. Time, date and place, or date, time and place, because time and place, that's history. All history. All testimony in court and all history is based on time and place. So that's the reason why we write it down, is not for court, but for the fact that it's history. And if you don't write it down, it's not history anymore, if you don't know the time and place. Now, all of my notes occur at my place of my studio, and my residence are the same building. It's all of my notes are taken at that location, unless I take my notes with me somewhere. So it's rare that I take any notes outside of my head office, so to speak. So this notebook really applies only to this one place. So in a sense, I don't have to write the place, but it's very important that the main details of time, place, date, time, place be known, if we want to have history, a history or the history or true history or an account of history. Stringing the instrument to pitch, I said. After I strung my instrument to pitch, okay, so I've got the Gibson Blue Ridge fret finishing, and I did it a certain way. I'm going to come back to that. Then I strung it, and I said, but before that, I measured the straight edge. It was a level fretboard. After I'd finished dressing the frets, I checked with the straight edge, and I found it was level from frets 1 to 11 on the low E side, and from frets 1 to 12 were level on the high E side. Stringing the instrument to pitch showed, then I put the strings on, in other words. You can't check it with a straight edge along the frets. Well, you can check it along the frets, the straight edge with the strings on, actually. It doesn't matter, but you can't check the fretboard at all with a straight edge, because the frets prevent that, they interrupt it. But unless you have a straight edge that has notches cut in it, and they do make those, you can check your fretboard then with the strings on or however. But I want to say that the point I was trying to get to was that I can't check. What was I trying to say? Let's see. Well, I strung it to pitch, but first of all, I checked it. Yeah, that's what I did. So I'm saying that I checked it. I could have checked it after I put the strings on, and I did. I checked it after the strings were on, too. But because it's very easy to do. I have a 12-inch metal ruler that's very straight. I was able to check from the first to 12 frets and find out that I had relief. You know, I didn't use the ruler after I put the strings on because I didn't need to, but I actually think I lied when I said that I checked it with... There's no point, because when the strings are on, the strings are a straight edge themselves. All you have to do is hold it down at the first and 14th. And when you hold a string down at the 14th and at the first fret, because it's under tension, it's a very dead straight line. Therefore, at the sixth fret, you can see what the relief is. So obviously, if I had a straight edge ruler on there, there would have been relief the same amount. So no need to do it. I did it using the string. But now, stringing the instrument to pitch, when I had strung it, the G string buzzed, okay? That string was buzzing. It's not buzzing now. And it was buzzing against one of the frets up somewhere up here. I'm not sure which one because it's hard to say. It's hard to tell. But now it's not buzzing. So why is it not buzzing now? I don't know is the honest answer, but I think that I know that I changed something, and it's very likely it's what I changed that caused the improvement, and that was I did loosen the truss rod further. Because originally I tightened it to do the fret dressing, and I loosened it to put it back. So loosening it an extra 12th of a turn helped, but I think even the loosening of that first 6th of a turn, that was a big improvement over just stringing it. If I just strung it and didn't put the truss rod back to where it had been by backing it off and loosening it that way, back to where it had been before I took the strings off initially, you know, and started the fret dressing, I would have had more buzzing here, and this string buzzes too, the E string. It's not buzzing much. You hear this? You're going to hear it buzz. Maybe not. I think you will. Hear that? It's hard to get it to buzz. When it buzzes, it just makes a little bit of a... It's not buzzing much. There. Sort of buzzes when it first strikes. It's excellent. It's doing excellently right now. So, the place where a string buzzes is always in the middle of the string, or where the fret is high, one or the other. Now, because if the frets are set up properly, it will always buzz in the middle first, because it vibrates at a... Although, if the relief is in exactly the shape of the string's vibration, then it will vibrate equally everywhere, but generally, since we don't put a lot of relief in the fretboard, it's going to buzz in the middle first, around the 12th fret first, because that's where maximum amplitude is, that's where the string reaches further towards the fret, and it will hit it first. So that's the region where we think there's going to be buzzing, in most cases, before anywhere else. So now we found, when the truss rod was backed off a 1/6 of a turn, there was significant relief in the neck, more on the high E side, like I said. But because neck relief was slightly less than 0.01, and I'm nearly finished, on the low E side, the truss rod, now the truss rod is in the middle, it affects both sides. But because the neck relief was less on the low E side, slightly less than 1/100 of an inch, therefore we loosened the truss rod another 1/12 of a turn, almost. Almost meaning that if it had been a full 1/12 of a turn, the edge of the nut would have been directly facing me, and it was just slightly away from center. That corner of the nut was just slightly shy of directly facing me. I don't know how much, probably just a matter of a couple of degrees of angle, or, you know, I don't think it was even 10 degrees. It might have been 10 degrees. It was very, if you're using 360 degrees, it might have been 1/36th of a complete revolution short. But that wouldn't be, that's probably, well, a 1/12th would be a 1/3 of a 1/12th. What it would be, right? It's nowhere close to that, because a 1/12th is between the face and the corner. If a 1/12th is between the face and the corner, it was nowhere near a 1/3 of that, so it wasn't a 1/36th. It was shy by, you know, a 1/12th of a 1/12th or something less than that, I think. It was less than a 1/12th of a 1/12th shy, probably, maybe about that. But okay, so the truss rod was loosened slightly less than a 1/2 a turn, I said. I should have said, I need to write that as a 1/12th, so. But I also wrote it, I wrote it twice. One time I wrote it wrong, so I'll have to edit that. I'll have to change that now. I better do that once I get back to my black pen, which I do not, I'm not, of which I'm not in possession at the moment. But the increased neck relief was caused by that turn of loosening of 1/12th, slightly less than 1/12th again, after the 1/6th. And the 1/12th additional turning was gave me a neck relief slightly more than a hundredth now on the low E side. And that was with the first and 14th fret held down and measured at the 6th fret. So that was decided to be good. I mean, we had achieved it with very little adjustment of the truss rod. I mean, a 12th of a turn gave us quite a significant change from less than 1/100th to more than 1/100th. So that's good, because that means our truss rod is working. That's the thing. I've never adjusted this guitar's truss rod before. I had no idea if the truss rod worked, if it was broken, or, you know, it wasn't rattling around when I first tightened it. So I assumed it was working properly, but this is the first time I'd ever loosened it. So, I mean, tightening it, loosening it should be the first thing you ever do to a truss rod. Don't tighten it first, because it might be as tight as it already can get, and by tightening it, you might break it. The first thing you should do is loosen it to determine how tight it is at the moment. Always, that's the first thing you should do with a truss rod. Make sure it's loose enough that it can be tightened before you tighten it. But the first thing I did was, you know, it was already loose when I first looked at it. It looked like it was, you know, the nut was not even tightened down to the surface. So it looked loose to me when I first looked at it, so I tightened it first. But obviously, it's not always that easy to determine. So therefore, and finally, we ended up with a total truss rod adjustment of 3/12, or actually slightly less, of a turn. And that gave us, and that was from the fret dress to flat position, and we had the change I wrote to the nut action, or first fret was minimal. Yes, right. And the reason I said that was because I had to set up the nut. After you do the fret dressing, all the frets are set properly, that's when you adjust the nut height, because your frets have now been lowered in this region. Provided they've been lowered on the first fret, you've lowered that fret, then you need to lower the saddle, not the saddle, the nut. This end, the nut, where the frets sit in the grooves in the nut, those grooves have to be filed a little tiny bit sometimes, and that's what you should always do. No more than a little bit, and then put the strings back. As soon as you see any material coming off I use a nail file, because the nail file was the only thing that fit in there. And you have to file at the right angle, angled downward towards the head, because you want the string to sit on the high spot on this side of the nut, not on that side of the nut. The highest part of the nut should be this side of the nut, so you angle it downward that way as you're filing. As soon as you take off the slightest amount of material, you're done. And then you put the strings back and try again. At least until you find out. And while you're look, and you also look with your naked eye at the nut holes and see how far they are from the fret board here, where you can look at an angle here with your naked eye, or a magnifier, or whatever you need. But my eyes work well without my glasses at close range, so I can see it well with my naked eye, and I could see that I'd lowered these holes substantially with the first tiny amount of material I removed, and I could see that the high E string was now considerably lower than the next string that I had not yet adjusted by filing that. And you have to, before you can file it, you take the strings out of the holes, obviously. You loosen them. So I adjusted these treble strings, the E, B, G strings. I took them out of the slots by loosening their tuning pegs enough to get them out of the slots and put them on the side, out of my way, and then I filed the three slots, the amount that I believed was necessary, and then, which was the first amount, the tiniest amount of material I could remove. And once I saw that the holes had looked like they were, even if the hole doesn't look like it's lower, I mean, if you think that you, and this happened to me twice already in adjusting the nut, I didn't have any accident, thankfully, because I know from experience that it might look like you didn't quite get a symmetrical shape on the hole that you were trying to file. So you want to remove a little more? No, don't do it. Try it first, because the string will probably carve the correct shape in the nut anyway, or we don't know what's going to happen. You may break strings because you file a little notch in there that shouldn't be there, or maybe you'll break them because you didn't do any extra work to round the hole. But you don't know that, and it's not a smart plan because you end up going deeper when you file. It's more likely than anything else, and so you're going to end up going too deep is the problem with that rationale. Once you go too deep, don't do it because it's not ever what you want. You're going to have to redo your nut. You're going to have to take it off and put a new nut on and rebuild, you know, design shape and file a whole new nut or shim it up by gluing a thin piece of perfectly flat and uniformly thick material on the back of the nut and then glue the nut back in place with one single dab of glue. But you're not going to want to do that. You're not going to want to do that at all. You should keep the nuts you have if it's completely, you know, if it's already great like it is on this one. At least it seems to be fine to me. So I can play. I've got reasonable ability to play without killing my, you know, without pain in my fingers. But I still might be able to lower this nut slightly. But when we're getting buzzing there, it's fret buzz from my fingers. Or maybe it's buzzing. Buzzing there. I'm not sure which string that is. Something is buzzing there, clearly. Borderline acceptable anyway, at the very least. Another thing that can be done when there's buzzing is the saddle can be raised by putting material underneath it. Either, I'm not sure if it needs to be glued even. I've certainly seen people putting material under without gluing it in the past, but that was when I didn't know very much about guitars. I'm not sure if that's the correct procedure or not. I wouldn't advise. I just advise looking it up on the YouTube. Look up the best experts you can find. Read everything that you can find. Find out and get a book. I've got a book on guitar building and maintenance. So I think that's another place I definitely always look. But I would do that as well and look to see what. And there's not only one right way, because circumstances might dictate. Especially if you're just experimenting, you don't need to glue anything. But you might have to, in some cases, glue it in order to get. I mean, a buzz could be caused by not gluing it in some to do with some parts in some circumstances of some particular construction of something. I mean, I would not want to generalize anything, but assuming that everybody agrees you're allowed to do it without gluing it, then of course that's different. But you might find that there's difference of opinion, or you might find they all say you have to glue it, or whatever. That's what you're looking for, is to get a whole bunch of opinions on the subject, and then you can decide what your application dictates, really, what you're doing will dictate the approach you would like to take in that particular case, and it won't be the same if you have another project. It rarely is going to be the same decision. At least that's my 2 cents worth. You need to make your own decisions on everything, but you need to be informed properly if you're going to make decisions. Otherwise, and you should never let anyone else make your decisions. Surely you should be, but before you can make a decision, you have to be informed if you're going to make a good decision. So how much information you need, I think that depends on the nature of the decision, really, on the importance of the decision, and so on. I felt that with this guitar, it's such an excellent instrument, and I don't know that I did an excellent job at all, because I think I still can lower the nut, but if I lower the nut anymore, I'm going to get, that lowers the string height slightly, and that's going to get more buzzing, but then I can raise my saddle, And if I raise my saddle, like I said, I don't know whether it's... Oh, actually, this saddle is adjustable on the Gibson. It has two screws. I think these are adjustment screws, because any saddle I had before, I never had a screw on it. I mean, there was no adjustment possible. That tells me that this is going to be adjustable. So, and I think I've read somewhere that the Gibsons, I've read something about adjustment. I'm not sure if it's this guitar, but it has to be adjustable if it's got screws, I think. That means this saddle, you got to loosen the strings first, then you adjust the saddle higher. Then you can, you know, lowering the nut, you're only going to usually lower the nut a tiny amount, but that's going to affect the vibration, the buzzing in the middle of the string slightly by about a half. I mean, if I lower this by, let's use large increments, for example, but it's not going to be large increments, but if I lower this by an inch, that's going to be lower by half an inch if this doesn't move at all. That's linear, because this is a straight line. So linear thinking. The middle changes by half whatever this changes by if this doesn't change. So whatever that, if this goes down a fraction of some unit, then that goes down half of that fraction. That's what's going to happen. So then I can raise this by the same fraction I lowered that. If I did that, this would stay the same, but I can raise this by even more if I want to, you know, increase the action, which will... I've not read anything recently, but raising this action is called the action, I guess you could say, but action is determined partly by that. But if you raise the action here at the saddle, you're going to increase the angle. Now, some people, it seems to me, I'm trying to think of the physics of it. If you're pulling on the soundboard, right, and you raise the point at which you're pulling, you're increasing the downward angle of the string then into the pinholes. Then you're pulling up more on the soundboard. That's bringing the soundboard into tension and bringing it into action or into effect more. So the higher the action on the saddle, the more the soundboard and the will interact or will, you know, will come be affected by the strings and by the tension in the strings. It will therefore resonate in sympathy more with the strings. The more action, the higher the action. That's because the string is angled down more steeply because the action is higher, the saddle is higher, the downward angle is greater. It increases the force because the tension is uniform, let's say, along the string, but when the tension is acting straight up on the board, that's a bigger component of the tension acting straight up than if it is at a very slight angle, then the component of that tension in the upward direction is much smaller. I think it's just a sign of the angle. So if you've got a 10 degree angle, which is so many radians or whatever, that's just the sign of an angle at small angles is the same as the angle itself. You've got 0.01 radians, and the sign of that is 0.01. So you've got at 0.01, if your angle is 0.01 radians, which think of radians, something like 57 degrees, so 0.01 radians is about 0.57 degrees. So if you've got only a 0.57 degree angle, you're only going to get 1/100th of the force of tension pulling up. But the sine of 30 degrees, you got a 30 degree angle, the sine of 30 degrees is 0.5. It's 50%. And that's no longer a small angle. 30 degrees, you can't say the sine of 30 degrees is the same as the angle itself if you take 30 degrees as being in radians. That's not true. And anyway, but it's about right, because if 57 degrees is a radian, 30 degrees is about half of 57, and the sine of 30 degrees is 0.5. So it's almost true even for 30 degrees, even for angles as big as that. The sine of the angle is this almost exactly in radians what the angle itself is. Up to 30 degrees, it's not too bad, actually. But I would have thought we only generally use it below 10 degrees as an accurate number. The sine equals the angle in radians. So, if you've got 30 degree angle of strings down to the top of the guitar, pulling on the top, but by virtue of these pins that hold the string to the top, you've got 50% of that tension acting upwards on this compared to 1%, we said, for whatever that angle was. It was obviously, it was 0.01 radians, but whatever it was. I guess it was, we said it was, it was 0.57 degrees, but because it was 1/100th of a radian, so it was 57 divided by 100. But 57 is not the exact number of degrees in a radian. It's somewhere around 57. Anyway, so we did some rough calculations just to show, and we saw there, I saw for the first time, that's the first time I ever thought about it. To be honest, I've thought about the physics of what the sine of an angle is, but the first time I ever thought about the top of a guitar and how the angle of the string affects the force on the top of the guitar. It's great to be able to do that, but I've done, you know, a lot of different things in terms of thinking about a lot of different problems of... nothing similar to this, but certainly using the same principles. I've used these same principles of physics many, many times in many different ways on different projects. So that's how we get to learn how to reason using science or using physics. But now, science is not a good religion. Okay, it's not. I want to say that because I've recently seen how the problem with science is once we believe a certain theory, then we try to get all the facts to fit our theory, and we tend to force the facts to fit the theory instead of looking at the facts in order to come up with the theory. We should be looking for new theories that explain the facts better, in other words. So this was a case where I didn't look for any new theory. I just used the old theory to understand how a guitar is designed. So I think we should be aware, though, that sometimes the facts don't fit the theory, and we need to be very cautious about trying to explain away the facts as being errors on our part when it's in fact the error in the theory sometimes. So let's be aware of that. But anyway, I think that we now understand a little bit about how, and now I want to get back to what we were saying. If we raise the saddle, we understand now how the action of the strings acts pulling on the soundboard. Now, if we raise the saddle, therefore, we're going to increase the angle of the strings downward, which enables the saddle acts as a fulcrum point where the strings pull from the saddle. They pull upwards. They put more pressure on the saddle, too, if we raise the saddle, because there's going to be a bigger angle, more tension. The same tension, exactly the same tension, but more tension in an upward direction, more of the component, the sine of that angle being in the upward direction. It's a greater upward force, more downward force, therefore that's Newton's third law. For every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. Again, that may not always apply, but we certainly use it. In this case, we believe it's true that it's essentially very close to true that, you know, we know that there's more force down on that saddle because there's more upward force on this because If the string is pulling on the soundboard, then the soundboard's pulling back on the string, too. The soundboard doesn't want to come up. It's stiff. It has bracing. It's pulling down. When you pull on it, it pulls back, and that puts force downward on the saddle. So by raising the saddle, we're going to have some different things happen, and we have to be aware of what they might be. It might cause increased wear, or the strings might dig into the saddle more deeply if it's a softer material, or, you know, we have to be aware of it. Or we could be in trouble if we are using a softer saddle material. Now, I'm not recommending a soft saddle material. I don't think that's a very good idea, but we need to be informed on it to some degree. So we have got... Now, we're going to have to investigate that, too, before we make any decisions, is what material is the saddle made out of, and, you know, how much, you know... What reason would I have what not to raise my saddle, etc. But assuming that we raise the saddle, we then gain height here, half as much as we raise this. So we can raise this by three times as much as we lower the nut, if we have to lower the nut to get an acceptable, comfortable plane near the nut. And that's the only reason we lower the nut. If we don't want to lower the nut too far, because then when I press on the third fret, I press on that fret, you hear that behind the fret, I can hear vibration of the string where it's not touching. It's touching the second and third frets, but not the first fret. That's why it will vibrate like that behind. If it were touching the first fret, pressing it down on the third fret would actually stretch the string a little further after it impacted the first fret. If I had to push down further beyond that, it would be stretching the string and changing the tension in the string, or changing the pitch of the string. So we cannot lower the nut any more than until it just about touches that first fret, when we fret there on the third, between the second and third frets. Fretting the third position is what tells us for each of the strings when the nut is set correctly, in that the string is just nearly touching the first fret. We want to be able to play. That's why we want to lower the nut so we don't have to press too hard. So once we've got the nut right, we can raise the action here if we need to prevent buzzing here. But now the other effect of raising the action, some people like it because as we've already discussed, this is the reason why we discussed it, is by raising the saddle, we have increased the pull of the strings upward on the top. That's putting the top in action more in the sound, and it creates a fuller sound. That's the only real reason to do it, because it's not, and the buzzing. The buzzing is the other reason, but obviously there's two reasons, but the disadvantage now, for some people find it difficult to play because the strings are far away here from the frets. You have to press down, to get your chord. The distance you'll have to press down is further, and if you want to play fast, you don't have time to press down very far if you want to play fast. So it takes a lot more skill, or it's more difficult to play with a high action. That's basically why people like to have a low action. I think we covered it now. So, a higher action will give us better sound, but it may be more difficult to play, especially in the region where the strings are high up, which is in this region here. And also, even though it gives us better sound and reduces the buzzing, that's the other thing, is that it reduces buzzing, better sound, but it's also putting more stress on the soundboard. But so there's another possible negative effect. You could wreck your guitar. If your guitar's soundboard is not braced properly, or if the bracing is loose, if it's an old wood, if the wood is old, if it's got a crack in it, mine does have a crack. It's got a crack right down here. But, I think you just should be aware that you don't want to raise anything or change anything here if you don't understand how strong the wood is here. And if you're not confident, and if you don't know enough about how guitars are made and how much tension you can put on it. And, for example, if I were... Another thing is the tuning. If I like to tune my guitar, let's say, higher, tighter, with the strings tighter and the pitch higher than normal, or higher than the way everyone else tunes it, that increases the amount of tension on the top, and that could destroy the guitar or damage it seriously by tearing either the bridge off of it or tearing the soundboard apart or something similar. So we don't really need to do that. We don't need to adjust the strings tighter. We can think about it, but we don't need to do it. And in some cases, on an older guitar, we might decide to tune the pitch down on a guitar to reduce the tension so as to prevent damage to the more, important parts of the guitar, which are the soundboard and, the bridge attached to the soundboard, these things that make it work and sound beautifully and so on. But I think we should also realize that tuning it down also makes the strings sound or vibrate more in a different manner too. If they're at lower tension, they're going to be it's going to be easier to pluck it so that it vibrates and buzzes like just there There's a buzz. Just a little buzz. No buzz there. No buzz there. Doesn't buzz every time. But the looser the strings are, the more they're going to tend to buzz. So there's an awful lot of things to think about there. And I think the real thing is to not do anything until you know what you're getting into. And that is a matter of research. And really, prayer is part of that. I mean, prayer is how you incorporate research through. If you don't feel right about something, it's because you didn't quite understand it. And you didn't quite, actually develop that knowledge to the point of faith. And faith is, it's not something that you need knowledge to have. Faith is, but you need, in order to have faith in a procedure, you have to have knowledge. But in order to have faith, you don't need anything. You just need faith. Jesus said the tiniest bit of faith, you can move the size of a mustard seed. Faith the size of a mustard seed, you can transplant mountains. Or it's limitless what you can do with faith. But knowledge is different. You need a huge amount of knowledge, really, to do something like this and do it. And do it, if you're doing anything. Well, even some of the simple things, like you might think that raising your pitch by tuning the strings tighter couldn't possibly hurt your guitar, right? Wrong. So I mean, it's not obvious with some of these things how much knowledge you really need. It's sometimes a lot more than you would think. So don't attempt to do anything, I think, is what I would caution you. Don't attempt to do anything until you've really meditated and prayed and studied and you actually understand in great detail what is going to be the consequence and why you're doing it the way you're doing it. So all the best, though, and use the best known techniques and the best known and develop better techniques than are known. That's the best advice that I can give you, because if you study from a variety of teachers, you're going to be better than all your teachers. And that's even in the book of Psalms. I think Psalm 118 is what it is. More knowledge than all my teachers have come to have. But I'll have to double check that. Anyway, I've got to change my notes. So great to talk to you again. And I've now got a guitar that the frets actually look shiny and actually sounds good. And I'm no longer getting buzzing on that note, which I used to get all the time, because I had a bump in the fretboard or the, in the frets. I'm not sure what caused it. It's gone now. And I treated my board. So the other thing is, okay, the final point that I was going to make, and I did afterwards, I used lemon oil on the wood of the fretboard, and that stuff is all over my fingers now. I can't get it off for a little while, but I'm going to wash my hands, but it's not going to come off for a while. But so how did I finish and polish up these frets? I used sandpaper. I found that obviously you can use expensive $80 files and things like that they make specifically for filing frets. Once you flatten your fretboard, all your frets are then flat on top. They're all flattened down, all the ones, not all, because I didn't even touch some of them. Or I just started to touch them, and then I was done. I'd done what I wanted to do, which was lower these frets down here, and in the process it lowered a few frets up here, and it took a bump out that was in here, only on the lowy side, but it lowered all of these frets, across the whole fret in this area, and across the whole fret in this area. And even though the whole board looked flat to me, it didn't really do as much in here, or hardly did any. So I think it did, actually, in the end, I think it did a little bit in most places, but not everywhere. The way we knew that, the way I knew that, the way everyone seems to do it often, is they put magic marker very carefully to not touch any of the wood, but just on the metal frets. Magic marker, I use red, but you don't use red on a white or maple, a white maple or a light-colored fretboard. Because red is, so you don't want that. That's what I was warned about, so I didn't do it. I use red here because I use red. And I mean, because I have rosewood here. It's a rosewood, or is it? Is it ebony? Anyway, ebony and rosewood are both fine. But I think it's a rosewood.